This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is July 11th, 2019, and this is episode 146. Politicoast is the BC Politics Podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by filling out our survey at politicoast.ca/survey. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Delonnebaum.
I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we have an interview with Seth Klein about what we're going to do since the world is on fire. And ironically, the pacifist leftist answer is go to war. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca.
And a reminder, fill out our survey at politicoast.ca/survey. Let us know what you liked about the show, what you think could be improved, and just any other feedback you have. As well, our 150th episode is coming up pretty soon, and we're going to be doing a live show on August 8th for that. Details should be out next week, so stay tuned for that.
And patrons, you should hear in the next couple days, I hope, how to get tickets early. So sign up at patreon.com/politicoast to be the first to RSVP. Seth Klein, public policy researcher and writer based here in Vancouver. Welcome to Politicoast.
Nice to be with you guys.
So, Seth, you're working on a book right now on climate change and how we need a war mobilization effort to combat that. Maybe let's first just start by talking a bit about how bad the situation is. We had the IPCC reports have come out in the past couple of years, and I think when we're not getting beat over the head every day, we sometimes forget things are bad, right?
Things are bad. Things are bad. It's not that there weren't warnings, but now, I think for the longest time, the public conversation about climate change always made it feel like it was happening somewhere else and sometime into the future. And now I think it's dawning on people that it's here and now. And the connections are starting to get drawn between what it is that we're doing that's causing climate change, namely burning fossil fuels, and that it's manifesting in forest fires, in floods, in extreme heat events, impacting food sources. And if anything, we've got it easy, that there are parts of the world where it's much more acute and that that's going to impact global peace and security and migration and so on. I mean, the IPCC has issued these reports over the years. There was something about the one last October, I think, that shifted people's mindset. There was something about how they framed it and the clarity of that report saying, if we don't get serious now and at least have emissions by 2030, we are in big trouble. And I think that's now where you're starting to see the student strikes and Extinction Rebellion, and everything's getting taken up a notch.
Do you think it was that 12-year number that got a lot of prominence? Because it's easy to think, oh, you know, 30 years, that's a while, you know, we can get to it. 12 seems a lot more immediate.
Yeah, it does. I do think that's part of it. It is more immediate. And even the fact that it was... And then we have to be zero by 2050. Because before now, like even now, BC's targets are outdated. We have a target that says we're supposed to be at 80% reductions by 2050. And what happens when you say, you know, we're going to reduce emissions by 80% by 2050 is everybody figures they can be accommodated in the last 20%. but of course, the math doesn't work that way. So this provides more clarity that way.
And so, like you said, we're seeing those effects here and now in Vancouver, in British Columbia, forest fires, increased king tides and issues like that. Can I blame the like shitty summer weather we've had where it's been like weirdly cloudy for the last couple of weeks on climate change?
Well, look, I'm not a scientist.
Sure.
I mean, I take my cues from the scientists, and the scientists say that it isn't simply about heating. It's about disruption. And about changing what's predictable and normal. So I don't know that you can explain every cloudy day that way, but certainly the increased frequency with which we are experiencing major events is related to climate change.
So you're not a scientist, but you were a public policy researcher, economist, and worked on that kind of issue with Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives for many years, BC office. We know from IPCC where we need to get to, zero by 2050. It's a big question, but how?
Well, I think it can be done, but it's going to be hard. Part of my own reason for leaving CCPA after 22 years was feeling that urgency and wanting to spend more time on it. And let me take a step back. So this book that I'm writing on is about mobilizing Canada for the climate emergency. And it's seeking to tackle this gap between what the science says we have to do and what our politics seems prepared to entertain. And there is this gap. And if you look at both British Columbia and Canadian GHG emissions, you know, annually going back to the year 2000, and you chart it as we like to do at CCPA, what you see is basically a flat line. Emissions are not going up. That's the good news. And they're not going down. There was a little downward blip with the recession in 2008-09. And otherwise, despite all the talk, we have basically spent the last two decades accomplishing precious little of nothing. And so whatever it is we've been doing isn't working. And my feeling as I approached this book was we need a new mindset, which is where I ended up landing with this frame of what can we learn from World War II, which was the last time we faced an existential threat and mobilized across society and quickly retooled our economy once we appreciated the emergency for what it was. And to be honest with you, Ian, I cut my political teeth in the peace movement. Unlike Scott, I started as a kid in the peace movement. I'm the last guy you would have expected to write a book about the war. But the more I've delved into that history, the more hopeful I feel, actually. Because what that history reminds us is that when we decide to get serious about something, we are capable of retooling and mobilizing at a scale and scope and pace that we can't quite imagine. You know, one of the things I take some solace in is when you look back at that history just before and immediately after Canada declared war in World War II, is that right up to the 11th minute of the 11th hour, the government didn't want to do it. They did not want to be dragged into this thing. Just like our governments now, they really, you know, the same kind of kicking and screaming, getting dragged there. And then interestingly, even when, the Nazis invaded Poland and 2 days later, Britain declared war, and a week later, Canada declared war. And then nothing happened. There was no fighting. We didn't rush into Poland. And so historians refer to this next 9 month period as the phony war. That's what it's called. I feel like we're in the phony war right now, you know, that we're having governments declare climate emergencies, except they're not really. Mm-hmm. They're not really there yet, or they haven't yet gotten their heads around what that actually means. What that history shows us is that when we finally get it, we can move so quickly, tells me that we can actually do this, which is a long-winded answer to your question.
So there's something about war that's kind of very visceral and tribal and kind of plays into a lot of kind of the more base human nature. And it's really easy to form an us versus them dynamic. And that helps motivate, you know, a nation to go to war and really kick things into gear. Can we get the same thing going when there isn't a them?
I think we can. I mean, you're right that it's not exactly equivalent. And yet, again, one of the things that intrigues me as I delve into this is that I think we assume in the rearview mirror that once, you know, we declared war, everyone was on board. That's not true, actually. There was all kinds of opposition. And remember where the population was at that point, right? World War I was still a fresh memory. They had just finished unveiling World War I, you know, monuments. They had just been through the Depression and were still wrestling with economic insecurity. This was not a population relishing the idea of going back into war. And so it actually took leadership to bring the public there and to rally the public. And so that's part of what I'm delving into in the book is, well, what did that look like then and what would it look like now? And even the role of media and culture and entertainment, right? And one of the things that intrigues me is that part of rallying that was arts and entertainment. Like, there was a soundtrack to World War II, and there were movies, and there were Hollywood stars selling victory bonds. And even on, there was a particular role, you know, in the Canadian case. Actually, let me come back a moment and point out that, you know, people often think, oh, well, people understood the threat in World War II to be clear and present. But actually, it wasn't clear and present. It was on the other side of the ocean. There wasn't an attack on Canadian soil. And unlike the United States, though, we didn't wait for an attack on our soil before we joined. But then, thankfully, as well, the government had created two helpful Crown corporations in the lead-up to World War II, the National Film Board and the CBC. The National Film Board is pumping out these 15-minute documentaries. And the CBC, you know, and I think there's an important question here for the CBC today. If I say to you, or to anybody really, the name Lorne Greene, depending on the age of the person, right, if you're, I don't know, you guys are both younger than me. For me, Lorne Greene was the admiral in the original Battlestar Galactica. You know, for my dad, it's Bonanza. But before he went to Hollywood, he started at the CBC. And every night during World War II, he was the CBC's broadcaster, and he was known as the voice of doom. We had a map, and he would read the latest, and there was maps on the news with showing you progress on the war. What's the CBC doing today? Right? I mean, if we can have...
They're posting articles full of tweets.
They're posting articles full of tweets. But my point is if the radio can have hourly, every morning, hourly sports reports and hourly business reports that are basically meaningless symbology to most people, surely they can have an every morning climate emergency report. And the nighttime news should have a map showing the forest fires and the floods and... Because these are attacks on our soil, actually. And so let's see it. And let's start to turn our attention there.
And so one of the criticisms of that approach in World War II is what you're describing with CBC and National Film Board can be described as propaganda efforts mm-hmm. by the government to convince people against their free democratic will. How do we get past that criticism?
Yeah. And only that, as we touched on right at the beginning here, you can't exactly point to a single weather event as a climate-caused thing. So how do you get over that hurdle as well?
Well, I would say you're right to raise the question and to have that caution. Of course, there is all kinds of propaganda out there already, particularly coming from climate deniers. I'd say you have to have it be science-based. It has to be rooted in that. But I do think, you know, there's this interesting debate happening now in the media where, you know, the Guardian newspaper is starting to change its language. It's not talking about climate change anymore. It's talking about climate crisis, climate breakdown, climate emergency. That is grounded in science. That is what we are confronting now. So let's use the right language. And, you know, so I think that should be the guide.
So throughout kind of Canadian military history, there's a tendency to underinvest and come in and have outdated equipment, not be great. And a lot of Canadians ended up dying in a bunch of different wars because we weren't ready. Are you concerned the same thing's going to happen here?
What is the procurement issue?
Yeah. Yeah. What is climate change's Ross rifle?
Right. Well, I mean, all of these cases. So first of all, when we look at lessons from World War II, there's both positive stories and there's cautionary tales. And some of the cautionary tales have to do with production of munitions. More importantly, they have to do with civil liberties. And I would say the response to refugees. And so that's part of my book too, right? How do we do it right this time? But I actually would say in the case of World War II, we actually have some very intriguing models to work with. Because once we got serious about it, the scale of the production was actually pretty impressive, right? Once it ramped up, and it took some time to get ramped up, Canada was producing 300 planes a week. Here in our province, so think about our province. Here we are, in an ocean-facing province. Back in the day, BC used to have a shipbuilding industry. It all went dormant during the Depression. We had a couple shipyards that were, basically doing repairs. That was it. And then war was declared. Now, here we are in our province where it seems we can't even get a damn ferry built, right? In World War II, in those next 5 years, just British Columbia, not all of Canada, so mainly Vancouver, a little bit of Prince Rupert, a little bit of Victoria, we built over 300 ships. 250 of them were large, like Liberty ships, 10,000-ton merchant marine cargo vessels. The minister in the King government who oversaw all of this was, particularly interestingly for me, C.D. Howe. Now, I say interesting for me because, as you know, I spent 22 years at the CCPA, and, you know, we had these two think tanks that were our arch nemeses, the Fraser Institute and the Toronto-based C.D. Howe Institute, named for this guy, who, the more I've dug into it, and as near as I could tell, was basically the minister for state planning in World War II. Now, C.D. Howe was a private sector guy. He was an engineer, incidentally, like you, Scott. And he had done really well in the private sector before going into politics. But he was practical and he was a man in a hurry. So he was happy to give all kinds of contracts to the private sector doing military procurement stuff. But if the private sector couldn't quickly do what needed to be done, he created a crown corporation. In the course of the war, this guy created 28 crown corporations, which is amazing to me, right? Because now, even purportedly, you know, left-wing governments in Canada, if you suggest to them that something needs to happen and if the private sector isn't doing it, let's just do it, that's sort of outside the realm of possibility to them. One of the challenges that we face with climate change is we, as a society and all of our politics across the political spectrum, are locked into this neoliberal straitjacket that limits our sense of what's possible.
It's interesting you mentioned C.D. Howe's business background and how he brought that kind of thinking into centralized planning in the government. It reminds me of a book I haven't read yet, but I'm going to be picking up, by Lee Phillips, a new one, People's Republic of Walmart, where he basically looks at how Walmart is the largest centrally planned economy in the world right now, probably, and how they've managed to build those supply chains.
Well, that book, incidentally, is co-authored by Mihail Rudworsky, who's local.
Right.
And I've just finished it. It's an excellent book. And I was drawn to it for the same reason.
Because, this is where we go all leftist and lose Scott.
Yeah, sorry, Scott. But part of what led me to the book was that, you know, I am intrigued by all of this planning that happened in World War II. And of course, you know, lots of people, I think, would say to that, well, that was World War II, but so much has changed now. You know, we can't do that kind of planning anymore. And the contention of this book, The People's Republic of Walmart, is that, in fact, if you look at Walmart and Amazon and the Pentagon, you know, these rank as the largest economies in the world. And they are completely centrally planned. And additionally, in some ways, the arrival of, you know, what we can now achieve with computers and algorithms and with big data actually make possible a kind of planning that wasn't possible then. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Scott.
So, yeah, I admittedly have a little skepticism on the how far you can push central planning, but
I want to clarify this point because I don't think this all comes down to a public versus private and so on. My point around the World War II story is this. There was a big role for the private sector, and a lot of people made a lot of money. But when you approach something as an emergency and understand it that way, the private sector wasn't allowed to decide on the allocation of scarce resources. The government did that because it had a job to do that was urgent and needed to be done. And I think we need to approach the climate question similarly.
Okay. There's probably some areas where may work best or better than others. Kind of what would be the kind of key areas you see as the best case scenario for central plan, for a role for a more central planned approach to this?
Well, so first of all, we have to set clear dates by which certain things have to happen. And, you know, maybe we can draw, I'll draw in the current BC plan to a certain extent. So part of why I think we lost so much time in this is so much of the debate hung around market-based solutions and, in particular, carbon pricing. Now, I'm in favor of carbon pricing, but it's been so politicized and politically weaponized that it just isn't getting anywhere close to achieving what it is that we needed to achieve. So a number of months ago, BC released its Clean BC plan, which is its climate plan, although it doesn't mention the word climate barely. What I liked about it is that, you know, it still involves some carbon pricing, but it's not all rooted in carbon pricing anymore. It's rooted in regulatory measures that say, this is going to happen by this date, this is going to happen by this date. So for example, you're not going to be able to buy a combustion automobile as of 2040. By 2032, all new buildings will be net zero. So I like that. My beef with the plan is, why the hell is it 2040? Mm-hmm. Why the hell is it 2032? That's not understanding it as an emergency. Or when you think about buildings, you know, one of the things that I like about where Vancouver's going now is that for a number of years, they've had a whole bunch of good measures about changing buildings, but they were all voluntary, right? incentivize this, encourage that. When you approach something as an emergency, so for example, if forest fires are threatening a community in the interior, we don't say to the people in that community, we encourage you to leave. Mm-hmm. We say, it's an emergency, you have to mm-hmm. go. That's what I mean by a different mindset. So I think we need dates that are much sooner, where we say, within a couple of years, all new buildings can't use natural gas for heating and hot water. We set a date by which all buildings are no longer using natural gas, that we're basically saying, we're turning off the switch as of this date. The date around cars should be, I don't see why it should be 2030, not 2040. And then you're sending a different kind of market signal. But also, I think as we move in that direction, in some cases, the signals will work and the market will do what needs to happen. And in other cases, they won't. So we're all being told to switch to heat pumps, right? I'm trying to do that in my own home. It's actually extremely complicated and difficult.
I bet.
And part of it is, I actually think that might be a case where you want a crown corporation. So you get economies of scale to import, either manufacture or import it, and save money on the cost. And you're able to clearly walk people through exactly what they need to do it. And instead of having a whole bunch of individual operators, you know, some of whom understand it and some of whom don't, it's coordinated. Or maybe the Crown Corporation is simply the coordinator and it's still the private operators who are doing it. You know, so those are all examples.
PharmaCare and heat pump care coming this fall.
Right, right.
So you mentioned Clean BC. It's inadequate. The federal government is going to an election this fall, and we've already seen pretty much all the parties actually start talking about climate, which is new and probably a good step, you think. But are any of them pitching a good enough plan?
Well, I quite like both the NDP and the Green climate plans. I think they're both imperfect, and actually they complement each other nicely. Mm-hmm. You know, the where the NDP plan is a bit weak, the Green plan is better, and where the Green plan is weak, the NDP plan is better. Particularly, I mean, I would say the Green plan is weak on the labor transition and on the social inequality dimensions. And the NDP plan is better on that. It's better on the role of Indigenous leadership through all of it. But the Green plan is better on fossil fuel infrastructure and saying no.
Well, except the part where they want to refine it in Canada.
There's that one piece of it that's a bit too clever by half. All of which leads me to hope. But of course, you know, the last time I was on a show with you two, of course, I was debating proportional representation. Mm-hmm. Man, that still hurts, that loss. because as I've done my research for the book, with the exception of the UK, all of the countries that are kicking our ass on climate have PR. And it means that there's a ratchet for progress to happen that doesn't get undone. You don't get these crazy pendulum swings like we're seeing in Ontario and Alberta now. But also, the climate issue has just become it's not a political wedge issue the way it is here. So that said, we don't have PR, and I think that was a terrible betrayal on the part of Trudeau's part, but it's still a possibility that the outcome of the next federal election will be a minority. And in that scenario, and that is my glimmer of hope in all of this, I think it's possible to imagine a minority coalition government or a minority government with something like a confidence and supply agreement, the terms of which start to look like a Green New Deal.
It was a minority government with support, the former Trudeau and Tommy Douglas, I think, that gave us healthcare.
David Lewis, yeah.
Or David Lewis.
Yeah.
But back in the day.
That's right.
Maybe that could happen again.
Yeah.
With an Elizabeth May also in there.
Yeah. No, I mean, wouldn't it be amazing? We could have a minority government where agreement has to be reached with the NDP and the Greens and Judy Rabel Wilson and Jane Philpott. Who knows? I mean, that could be interesting.
Speaking of the other parties, though, there are the Liberals and the Conservatives.
Well, I don't think we should even waste too much time on the Conservatives' non-climate plan. I mean, there's lots of stuff out there in the media dispensing with that. The Liberal one, you know, the Liberal Party has people that get climate change, and genuinely. This is partly what I've been wrestling, why I wanted to take on this book, is this dilemma of what I call the new climate denialism. So unlike the old denialism, which was like denying human-induced climate change, the new climate denialism, which in many ways is more insidious, says, yes, we get climate change, we accept the science, and yet you still practice a politics and policy that clearly doesn't. And that's how I view the liberal take on all of this, the federal liberal take. You know, it's kind of it's telling the public, you can have it all. You don't need to make choices. We can be serious about climate and still increase fossil fuel extraction and export, and you don't have to make those hard choices. And that's simply not true. We do have to make these choices today. And to double back to my book and the kind of leadership that we had then, you know, I've interviewed a number of politicians for my book and political insiders, and in one way or another, they very often all land back to this line, some incarnation of the line that says, well, you have to meet the public where they're at. But the thing about the leaders who we remember from World War II is that they didn't meet the public where they were at. They took the public where they needed to go. That's what the kind of leadership we look for in a time of emergency. That's what I hope we get.
You mentioned earlier how you're not a fan of carbon taxes as the main driver of the policy, in part because it does get so politicized. But how do you stop whatever the other policies are from just becoming just as politicized? Because there's no reason carbon taxes, for example, needed to be quite as strong as, you know, practically out of the right-wing model mm-hmm. almost on how to deal with this, yet it became very polarized.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not a risk just whatever the other policy is gets a similar
Well, there's
level?
Something tragic about how this is playing out in Canada right now with different conservative leaders in particular. And incidentally, this is, I mean, I said I wasn't going to talk about the conservative plan, but I think, again, out of the research that I'm doing, today's conservative leaders are not your grandparents' conservative leaders. And I think there's a message to be said to small-C conservatives out there that that these people don't deserve you. You know, small-C conservative values, as I'm sure you can appreciate, Scott, involve, you know, protection of people and children and future generations and security. That's not what we're getting. And the conservative leaders in World War II, in the face of an emergency, rallied people and said, we can do this. Unlike these man babies today who hold temper tantrums and say, don't make me do it. But that's how Scheer and Ford and Kenny, that's what these guys are. Now, we do have some Canadian examples where it didn't get weaponized in this way. You know, interestingly, if you put aside the carbon pricing stuff, and this is where Mark Jackers, you know, makes this argument, we both in BC and Ontario, we've simply regulated how electricity production will happen. Jacker makes the point that, you know, if you look at the Campbell government, the Gordon Campbell government, he brought in the carbon tax. He also said we are not going to have coal-fired electricity. The latter of those moves is responsible for three times the carbon reduction that the carbon tax was, but the carbon tax took all the political oxygen and in that case became weaponized by the NDP in the lead up to the 2009 mm-hmm. election. Similarly, the North American jurisdiction that has achieved the most GHG reductions is Ontario because of the phase out of coal-fired electricity. Now, that wasn't without its challenges, but they did it. And it's done. No one's going to undo it.
Right, and that comes me to my next question is coal-fired power plants is kind of the very low-hanging fruit, and there's a lot of other ones we can get to, better electrification, transportation, a bunch of these stuff, but there's also some things where we just don't really have a good alternative right now. Concrete, for example, very useful, using a whole lot of things, and you know we can maybe use less of it in buildings, but there's other applications we'll still need it for. It produces a lot of CO2.
Yeah, and there actually are technological alternatives on
in
cement.
The works, but
I thought you were going to say plane travel, which I think is the harder one.
There's also that, and some work being done on biofuels and stuff. But there's a bunch of stuff. Steel production's another one.
There's electric arc furnaces doing steel, too.
Yeah, but there's stuff where it's not necessarily easy, or there's a solution ready now. And we can't just, you know, okay, innovation, as some like to do it. So how do we address
those? So first of all, I would say this. We can get almost all the way, and we can certainly achieve that 50% reduction by 2030 with technology and policies that are simply sitting on the shelf waiting for us. Getting to zero is probably going to require a few more technological innovations by 2050. I think those will come. You know, this amazing young woman, Greta Thunberg, who everyone's talking about from Sweden, who initiated all the climate strikes. I don't know if you saw, but she ended up giving a speech to MPs in the UK a day or two after the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And she said to the MP, the British MPs, we need cathedral-like thinking to tackle this. She said, we don't know how to get all the way. We know what we need to know to rebuild the foundation, and we'll figure out the ceiling when we get there.
Which is an unsatisfying answer for engineers, but I think it's an honest one. I think it is.
But look, right, we can get almost all the way, and so much of it is waiting. I mean, if you look at Norway and Sweden, for example, like us, they are heavily reliant on ferries. They have a schedule to shift their ferries to electric using electric battery technology from a Richmond-based company that we're not using in our own province. Like, we don't have a schedule to get our ferry fleet converted. Why not?
So there's, on the other hand, a lot of people making the argument, even the BC NDP, even the federal liberals, that one of the things we can do is transition fuels, the LNG approach, or, you know, if we can displace dirtier fuels, we can get ourselves a few steps in the right direction. But I get the sense you're against the LNG projects in BC and the pipeline expansion.
I view those as other examples of the new climate denialism. Might there have been a time 20 years ago when we could have thought of natural gas as part of a transition? Yes, we ran out the clock. Time's out. So we need to leap right into the full renewable electric alternatives. And additionally, in that ensuing period, the conventional sources of natural gas have basically become exhausted. So it's all fracked now, and it's all producing a level of methane that makes it equivalent to coal.
And so what do you say to the people reliant on or hoping for those potential jobs in the short term?
Well, that's an important distinction, first of all. I mean, part of what baffles me about where BC is going with LNG, in some ways I can understand the dilemmas in Alberta, where you have tens of thousands of people currently employed in the oil sands trying to figure out their future. But here's an industry that doesn't even exist yet. And we had to pile on the incentives up the wazoo just to make one of these things bite. So this is a terrible example of the road of, you know, investing billions of dollars down in something new on exactly the road we want to get off. For those who are current workers, I like to make this distinction. No one's saying we have to turn off the tap tomorrow. When it comes to phasing out, bitumen and the oil sands, we have 20 to 30 years before 2050. It's about setting off on the right direction. What it does mean is that you don't spend billions of dollars on new fossil fuel infrastructure that moves us in the opposite direction. For a lot of those workers currently work in the oil sands, you know what happens in the next 20 to 30 years is they retire. So in some ways, the more challenging just transition issues are actually less about the individual workers and more about the communities that are reliant on those industries. And those issues are real. Like, we need a fulsome transition. Any worker, including historically in forestry in British Columbia, who's heard the language of just transition, is understandably cynical about it. Because so often these promises get made and then they don't deliver. And people in Alberta are going to experience that now around coal because Jason Kenney is removing a lot of it. So the key is that it has to be resourced. And again, I come back to the World War II example. What's interesting about it is that it was resourced. You know, war liberates the purse strings. We spent an incredible amount of money to make this transition happen. We achieved full employment. We matched people to the jobs that needed to happen. And even in terms of what we did for returning soldiers becomes, I think, an interesting lesson for just transition for energy workers today, right? We had income support. We had housing. We had free post-secondary education. So let's do that again.
You're not going to ask how much it costs?
It's going to cost.
This is one of those areas where I'm pretty much on the, just borrow a bunch of money.
Let me say something about the cost, in World War II, right? So they sold victory bonds, and so that was debt. And Canada came out of World War II with a lot of debt, a higher mm-hmm. debt to GDP level than we've ever had since, even in the big 1990s so-called debt crisis. It wasn't as high as it was after World War II. And it was fine, you know? But that heralded a 30-year period that saw the strongest economic performance we've ever experienced. But we also paid for it at the time in new taxes. Corporate taxes in World War II went from 18 to 40%. And more than that, this is actually an interesting dimension of it as well. The King government, one of its highest priorities in the war was to try to avoid having to bring in conscription, right? Mm-hmm. Because of how that had played out. I know you guys are interested in your history and all of that. And so they knew that they were going to need hundreds of thousands of people to voluntarily enlist and offer up their lives. That's a big ask. Now, if you're going to make a big ask like that, you need social solidarity. You need people to feel like everyone's in. Now, that hadn't happened in World War I. In World War I, a lot of companies, there had been a lot of profiteering. Mm-hmm. A lot of people had made a lot of money. And so you had some people, making the ultimate sacrifice and other people making a killing. And it eroded social solidarity. So what did the government do at the beginning of World War II? Well, they went back to all the corporate books in the 4 years before the war, which were depression years, remember. And they averaged out the profits and they said to every company, big and small, in World War II, not only is your corporate tax rate going from 18 to 40%, but this is your annual profit limit until the war is over. If you hit beyond that, your top marginal tax rate was 100%. That's what the federal liberal government did in World War II.
Just to crack down on profiteering.
To crack down on profiteering and to build this sense that everybody was in this time.
So one of the challenges of the Second World War is the social cohesion was large, but there was social exclusion as well and mm-hmm. racism. And you mentioned briefly earlier the crackdown on civil liberties and the
response to refugees.
What do we need to do differently or learn from that?
Well, we have to do exactly what you just said. We have to learn from it and we have to do it differently. So that's part of what I'm wanting to include in the book are these cautionary tales that say, look, it wasn't all perfect. And this time we can't allow these things to happen. And the refugee one, I think, is particularly apt because the global movement of climate migrants is going to be one of the defining issues of the next 50 years. Canada has a terrible history of how it responds to people on the move, particularly when they come by boats. Ironically, the Trudeau government just a few months ago issued a formal apology for the turning away of the MS St. Louis with refugees during World War II. And I thought about that in terms of the book that I'm writing because, the great Indigenous child welfare advocate, Cindy Blackstock, who I assume you're familiar with, she has this wonderful kind of one-line definition of reconciliation, which I have always liked, which is that reconciliation means not having to say you're sorry twice. We just said we're sorry. So what is it going to look like to not engage in something shameful like that again? There are examples of when we act in a way that brings out our best selves rather than our worst selves. This isn't a World War II example, but it is a post-war example. In the 70s, when the world was trying to respond to what were called the boat people, the Vietnamese who were escaping, who had left war-torn Vietnam. And there was this global challenge put out by the United Nations, right? There were thousands of people who were displaced and every country was asked, to welcome their share, similar to the Syrian refugee crisis. And at the time, the initial response from Pierre Trudeau, Trudeau Sr., was, we'll take 5,000. Marion Dewar, Paul Dewar's mother, the late MP Paul Dewar, mm-hmm. his mother, Marion Dewar, who was also an MP, but before that, at the time, was mayor of Ottawa. And when she heard Trudeau say, we'll take 5,000, she said, oh no, we'll take 5,000 in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And she challenged other cities to match them. And in the space of a few months, that 5,000 figure became 60,000. That's when we were the people that we want to be.
So one thing that happened during World War II is governments took a fairly heavy hand, the federal government took a fairly heavy hand with other governments. I know locally here in Vancouver, there was a war measure order that basically legalized rooming houses across the city, and the city then spent the next 40 years trying to undo that bit by bit. But
I don't know that story.
I'll send you a link to it. But there's a bunch of stuff like that. Do you see a role for, say, the provincial government or the federal government to crack down hard if a North Shore community, for example, refuses to put in new transit infrastructure. Just picking an example at random here and take a much more heavy hand. And do you see that kind of potentially complicating the cohesion that we were talking about earlier?
Building SkyTrain via the War Measures Act.
Yeah.
So thankfully, we don't have quite the, you know, interestingly, the in the wake of the FLQ crisis in 1970, the War Measures Act was replaced by a new Emergencies Act, which tries to temper that heavy hand, and that's probably a good thing. That said, we may occasionally need a heavy hand. We're seeing an interesting example of that play out now federally with the provinces around carbon pricing, right? There was a federal regulatory backstop that said, if you don't do it, we're going to do it. And so far, it's now been subject to two court challenges that have decided that that is within the federal government's rights. And I agree. There is a real challenge here, as you're getting at, of you know, the classic Canadian Confederation quagmire that often blocks progress that needs to happen. And here, too, I think the frame of understanding climate as an emergency helps. National security is federal, and we're going to have to invoke that when necessary to do what has to be done.
Well, I think we've taken up a fair amount of your time and covered quite a few issues. Is there anything else that's been fascinating in your research for this book that you might want to close us off with? Maybe an anecdote or story that was just crystallizes the points you're trying to, this analogy you're trying to draw?
Well, yeah, maybe I'll just say this, and it kind of comes back to your earlier question about whether or not we can do this. And it's this observation is both the most obvious and yet also the one we, I think, often forget. The whole of society got transformed. And all of these people, you know, threw themselves into war production at home. And a million Canadians enlisted out of a population base of only 11.5 million at the time. So basically 1 in 11. So it's a scale of mobilization that is extraordinary, right? Mm-hmm. But here's the thing that they didn't know. They didn't know if they would win. But they did it anyway. We know in the rearview mirror how the story ended, but they didn't. And there was a good chunk of the period between 1940 and 42 when it was really an open question who would actually prevail. But they did what they had to do anyway. And I think that's also this ambiguous period we live in now. You know, the ultimate truthful answer to your questions about, you know, can we do this in time is we don't know. And we have to do it anyway.
Seth Klein, where can people find you online if they want to follow you until the book comes out?
I did create a website after I left the CCPA, which is just sethklein.ca, I think. I'm barely using it myself. And my book will be out in the fall of 2020. So it'll be a bit of a wait. Maybe you can plug it again on your show when it comes out.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for joining us. Moving on to quick takes. The provincial government has released more information about bringing in ride-hailing to the province. So applications to have a ride-hailing service are going to open up on September 3rd, and the regulations are supposed to be enforced by the 16th of September, and in theory, we'll have ride-hailing by the end of the year.
It's all going to come down to the final details that haven't been worked out by the Passenger Transportation Board, whether our cobbled-together system will be appealing enough to Uber, Lyft, and other companies besides the taxi companies cater ride hailing thing that I see all around Metro Town, but I don't know if anyone has used yet.
Yeah, I actually regularly pass a cater car on my way to the SkyTrain station.
Oh yeah, there's like two dozen parked outside Metro Town.
Yeah.
The other regulations that had already been announced are you're going to need class 4 licenses to drive, you're going to need criminal and driver records checks. There's going to be fines of up to $100,000 a day for any illegal operators, and there'll be a standard 30-cent per trip fee to go towards making more accessible ride-hailing options available. The things we don't know are what's going to be the cap on supply, what are going to be the boundaries for these systems, and what are going to be the fares. Because that first one is the most controversial, because the NDP have said there will not be more than X number of ride-hailing vehicles available.
Just not great.
Like, other than the fact that that's a way to keep down congestion, which is the big issue.
The
big issues.
Well, I mean, let's be real. The big issue is taxi companies have a fair bit of political pull for whatever reason. And politicians are reluctant to really take them on to the extent that I think would be ideal and kind of bust up some of the taxi cartel stuff. But yeah, with congestion, I mean, we should just have a congestion charge. Like, a lot of the concerns about ride hailing in general are really like concerns of other policy areas, that ride hailing is just, okay, you're doing stuff with cars in cities. It's already not going to be great. Or there's labor stuff, which, yeah, that's labor law. That's not really like a ride hailing issue directly. So, I mean, the stuff in this announcement is more ride hailing specifically, but like a lot of the complaints, including congestion, for example, are really like other policy areas that ride hailing only gets the attention because it's new and it isn't like the main cause of congestion or anything.
Well, and the other reason people care is because people come to Vancouver from other cities and they're like, why can't I get an effing Uber from the airport to downtown? And you go, there's a SkyTrain that's cheaper and faster, but people like their Ubers.
Yeah, well, I see this all the time, like online and Elm Tots and everything. And it's great if you're going downtown. If you're going anywhere else in the lower mainland, yeah, transit's kind of terrible to get from the airport to a lot of places.
That's true. Where I live now is not direct for the airport.
Same thing for the ferries. Like, trying to get from my work in Burnaby to the ferries is, it's quicker to go home and then go to the ferries.
So, ride hailing by the end of the year. The other big announcement from the BC government this week is we're getting money from the speculation tax. The government tries to pitch it as a big victory and that it's working. That's a harder question. What we do know is that 12,000 people have paid it and we've raised $115 million, which is not too shabby. It's more than the $87 million they'd hoped. And that is mostly because it turns out empty homes are more expensive on average than occupied homes.
Interesting tidbit there. What was actually surprising to me is just how low that number was. Like, if you look at the City of Vancouver empty homes tax data, that's just for the 250,000 odd households in the City of Vancouver. And that generated 8,000 returns, which, like, still as a proportion is pretty small overall. And, like, the empty home stuff, I think, gets blown out of proportion sometimes. But even so, like, going from just one municipality in the region to the whole region, plus Victoria region, Kelowna, and a few other places, I think it would be a little more than 12,000. Like, this is just fairly, like, a fairly small number for a region that, for a series of regions that's probably 1.5 million households.
The government does like to plump up that 99.8% of BC residents are not paying this tax, because it turns out most of us don't own two homes. And these regions. I think the reason the number might not be so much bigger than the City of Vancouver's alone is just where the desirability is. I think Vancouver's far more interesting
Although,
of a marketplace.
A lot of the pushback to this was more the Gulf Islands and Kelowna than Metro Vancouver, which is more vacation homes. And that was always one of the major criticisms. And like, there's a bunch of hay made of this when it was first brought in, but it's kind of gone away now. And I think once people got over the initial grumbling of having to fill out another government form, it's more or less disappeared as a political hot potato.
Yeah, if only 12,000 people are being hit, very few of them get to vote in this province, and we're making $100 million off of it. And that's this year. Next year, the foreign owners and satellite families percentage of tax goes from 0.5% to 2%. So either few of them are going to be paying it or those who are going to be paying quadruple. So we'll probably be making more money going forward. And all of that money is being used to build affordable housing, as far as I remember the press releases on this. Of course, money is fungible and it just goes all over the place. But overall, it seems like a political win.
I just don't see it making a huge difference one way or the other. I mean, just like, some people want to see it as action being done, but as a policy lever, I think the political rhetoric around it has outstripped its usefulness as a policy. And like the economic arguments have merit, and like, on the margin, it made sense. It just doesn't move the margin very much.
Well, at the very least, it's a bunch of money to build temporary modular homes, and that's helpful.
Well, looking outside of BC to our next door neighbor, Premier Jason Kenney in Alberta has decided to unilaterally be a lot more open to interprovincial trade than the deal the previous Alberta government worked out with the Canada free trade agreement. It was ridiculous we had to have an internal free trade agreement, but Jason Kenney announced during the meeting of the premiers this week that 13 of the exceptions the previous Notley government had managed to get inserted into that free trade deal, he was unilaterally withdrawing from, and they pretty much all have to do with government procurement. So rather than an Alberta first policy when it comes to governments buying stuff, they'll go with, okay, which Canadian company is cheaper, which is reasonable, and we'll save Alberta a bit of money and, you know, be good for the country as a whole. It would be nice if the rest of the country does too, and that's what Kenny's hoping to get out of this in part, is that it will nudge the other premiers to do similar moves.
My biggest knock against this is the obsession with this red tape reduction task force or whatever he's calling it, which is just conservative rhetoric for the base, but fine. And his claim this will create Alberta jobs, which is a tenuous claim at best, because most likely this will actually, in the short term, probably cost Alberta some jobs, even if it saves them some money. If every province removed its barriers, it'll probably mean that the big manufacturing centers get more jobs, so Quebec and Ontario.
It's going to depend a bit. And part of it is by saving money on procurement, you can do more procurement, because like individual projects are costing less, so you can spread the same budget out across more. So it's not out of the question that the end result tends to be, might be fairly net neutral for Alberta employment, but in the benefit is they get more stuff.
And honestly, I'm on board with making sure credentials in BC and Alberta are transferable with New Brunswick and Ontario. I don't see any issue with that. I mean, we both have gone through engineering and you hold an engineering certification. That's not the worst to try to transfer, but the fact there is more than that, there are provinces where perhaps you need to take additional courses. Like, we should be able to sort this shit out. I think part of it is because we don't actually have a national education strategy that points out that, and because education is a provincial issue, but nationally we're never looking at what are people learning? Are they learning the same things across this country? And does that make it transferable? It's like some basic country building shit.
Yeah, the engineering stuff isn't actually too bad if you have a Canadian degree, and there might be some additional tests. Or it depends a bit per province. I don't know all the provinces' rules on that because, you know, BC-based, but I think the bigger issue is a lot of the trades stuff is a lot harder to transfer. So that'd be, yeah, good to address.
Well, looking at jobs at the federal scene, one person who is out of a job, but voluntarily, is Lieutenant General Paul Winnick. He's the Vice Chief of Defense Staff, essentially the second in command of our armed forces, correct? Cool. He quit. Now, he was planning to retire anyway. He had been asked to stay on for an additional year to help the military kind of weather this whole Mark Norman stuff and all of the other...
The Vice Chief of Defense Staff being Mark Norman's job prior to that whole affair.
So when it seems like he just declined to take that offer and said, no, I feel like it's a good time for me to just go live in a cottage somewhere. And I don't blame him.
It does sound like there were some tensions between him and the Chief of Defense Staff and perhaps the political apparatus above the CDS that might have made him more eager to retire, but it's hard to say, and generals generally don't talk too much about that sort of thing, but that's definitely what the media reports are hinting at.
We thought Mark Norman was out of the news.
In fact, I think last time we talked about them, we said this was going to be our last time we talked about
Mark Norman. There's still the little ripples of the story. True.
Yeah, and
shaking up.
The opposition tried to get another media cycle or two out of it. Got a couple stories in the paper. But yeah, the ripples are getting progressively smaller. So Rear Admiral Jeff Zwick will be filling in temporarily until the Deputy Vice Chief of Defense Staff, Major General Francis Allen, returns from leave, at which point there will probably be a formal announcement on who gets the promotion. But it might not be entirely smooth sailing, in part because the reason Post Media was talking about this is they got a bunch of correspondence sent to them by officers who are, the story describes as, supportive of Winnick and who are frustrated about Vance's leadership. So doesn't sound like everything is hunky-dory at NDHQ right now.
I mean, the irony of leaks coming from the military now, after the entire Mark Norman affair was based on leaks to the media from the military, it's not lost on me. So, good times. Maybe I'm a little more skeptical of Canada's ability to mobilize a war effort, or we just won't rely on the Department of National Defense.
I haven't looked at it from the inside. Like, the military projects an appearance of organization that is greater than its actual organization. So, maybe that we will. But the Vice Chief of Defense Staff position isn't the only senior appointment that's going to be made in Ottawa, as the vacant Supreme Court seat filled by Justice Gasson's retirement will be filled with Justice Nicholas Cazerer. So he's getting appointed to the Supreme Court from the Quebec Court of Appeals, and he's been on the Legal Scientific Advisory Committees and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada.
Those are just interesting things I found in his bio. So he's formerly a McGill Law professor, spent a decade on the Quebec Court of Appeal. Seems like a relatively uncontroversial pick.
Well, yeah, that's generally the case with when you posted it in our Patreon Slack this morning, I'd momentarily forgotten Justice Gasson had retired, which the mere fact that you can forget there's a Supreme Court vacancy in Canada just makes it so much better than what happens in the States.
Well, it's not technically a vacancy yet because Gasson is not retiring until like the day before the writ drops.
But
that was the one scandal element of it. But yeah, I did go through because one of the neat things, I haven't decided whether it's really great or if it's just neat, things about Trudeau's public application and appointments process for the Supreme Court, among other things, is we get to read the questionnaire of Justice Cazerer to see what he thinks about issues. And he has long-form essays in there about whether he thinks the role of judges is to make laws or to interpret them. And he waxes poetic without really answering the question in a interesting, but I don't, like, everything in there was interesting and well-written, and it's very fun for me to read, but I don't think any of it was, like, particularly radical or new. And that's probably good for the Supreme Court of Canada. You don't want it being entirely filled with radicals. Maybe one or two. It's always fun to throw a wrench in there. It is kind of interesting that Trudeau didn't go for an Indigenous candidate, another woman, or kind of anything other than a white man, but I don't know offhand what the applications were.
In fact, they generally don't release the applications unless it's to try and discredit people in the middle of a scandal, like we found out with one of the previous appointments when that was leaked during the whole Jody Wilson-Raybould affair. But yeah, generally this stuff's kept confidential.
I think they listed the top three applicants in one of the last rounds, but maybe I just missed it this time. Having to choose a justice from Quebec is a bit harder because they have to know the civil code, and there are only so many justices who've proven their chops at that. So, uncontroversial pick. I tried to read what his, you know, influential cases were, and he's got a really wide range of interests, you know, stuff on civil law, stuff on criminal law, stuff on some, like, how the charter comes into effect with some criminal stuff, unreasonable search and seizure type stuff, which is interesting in a very active topic of charter litigation these days. So I guess it'll just be interesting to see how he adds to the court when he gets there and starts writing decisions. No red flags is what I took away.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. For a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Shoshana Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.